Welcome to another presentation from the House of David Fellowship in Richmond, Virginia. I'm Lee Miller. Today we're going to continue the series that we began a few months ago on Acts. We are kind of parked at Acts 15, as this is going to be part three of what looks like is going to be many parts dealing with the discussion of Acts, but first we have to build a foundation for what took place in the beginning. So that's what we're going to be doing today. We're still going to be discussing verse 1, and of course it's slightly repeated at verse 5 with a couple of important pieces of information. Our focus text today is going to be Matthew 18, 23 through 35, and of course we'll probably touch on some other texts rather quickly. Some of them I have in here, and then others you may have to check for yourself. But anyway, so let's go ahead and get started. What we're going to do is we're going to take a look at what's coming today in this particular presentation. We're going to review Hesed. Hesed is going to be one of the major things we're going to discuss, and we're going to review briefly what happened with Hesed when Rahab met with the spies, when they came into Jericho initially before the invasion, and that event that took place there. Then we're going to look at the passage in Micah 6:8, a passage that is very familiar to many of us, except it doesn't say what you think it says, so I'm going to show you what it says today. Then, of course, our subject is Acts 15, and we're, like I said, kind of stuck at verse 1 and verse 5 because we need to be sure that we are clear about what took place and why it took place in verse 1. I'm not worried about the other 30-some verses. I only want to be settled on what happened in verse 1 and why. Just want to be settled on that. And like I said, the text that we're going to be studying, we're going to look at every verse in 18 from 23. We're going to stop at 27 because we're going to have to ask some questions about forgiveness. And then, how can we have a presentation that does not have fun with math? I mean, it wouldn't be House of David. And then finally, we'll end our scriptural discussion, the focus of it, at the end of Matthew 18. We're going to then do an analysis of what we have seen today, and we'll pick up the other part of it at the next meeting. And the reason I say that is because when I was assembling, I do a lot of study and I collect notes and I just keep them set aside. And then when it came time for me to pull out the notes this week, and I'm looking at all these notes, I'm going, this isn't going to happen in 40 minutes. This is just not going to happen in 40 minutes. So we will pick up the other part of it at the next meeting, and I'll point out a couple of things that are going to happen there. Okay, so I'm going to review with you the definitions that we set for Hesed so that as we go through the text, maybe some of these things will come back and you'll go, oh yeah, that's right. The first one is establishing relationships. The second was acting for another's good. Third is distributing what you are given. And the fourth one was you need to expect a return. That's the definition of Hesed. Of course, we'll get into more as time goes on, but I wanted to give you a basic foundation and then show you these things in action. One of the things about Hesed, it's always involving relationships. It's always in action. It's never found as a good thought, a noble intention, sympathetic emotion. That is not Hesed and never will be. It's always in the doing of something. So if the doing is not happening, there's no Hesed there. So just a note. In action, what happened with Rahab and the spies? Went over it last time. She made a deal. And it worked out to the benefit of her family, and who knows, now she shows up in the lineage. So that was pretty good. Now, Micah 6:8. This is mostly KJV. How many people are familiar with this? There's even a song about this text, just this verse. He hath showed thee, O man, what is good, and what doth Yahweh require of thee? Three things. What's the first one? We know it as to do justice, right? And then what's the second thing? I'm not going to tell you. Okay? And what's the third thing? To live obediently before your Elohim. That's just what the text says. So what is the second one? Three things the Almighty requires of us. Justice, to live in obedience, and to love Hesed. That's what the text really says. Everybody chase to that text and look it up. All right, let's go back and review Acts 15. So men came down from Judea, began teaching the brethren, unless you're circumcised according to the custom I've highlighted of Moses, you cannot be saved. And of course, verse 5 just restates, mentioning a very important point, these people were saved. They were believers that Yeshua was the Messiah. All right, this was a quote from E.P. Sanders, which I'll tell you who wrote this in a moment. Argued 30 years ago, the vast majority of Jewish sources from the time of Paul understand that what is salvation? It is participation in the covenant that God established with his people. That's how the whole thing starts. He establishes a covenant relationship with the people he brings out of Egypt. That's the beginning. Now, this is from the book that E.P. Sanders wrote, Paul and Palestinian Judaism, and this quote that I have taken it from is from Pamela Eisenbaum's Paul Was Not a Christian, the Original Message of a Misunderstood Apostle. And what this book is bringing out is the different ways that you can read what Paul says, and you can make it say this, and you can make it say this. And so what she's trying to do is show those different things and where they started and where they led. That's what she's reading this book. And I'll have some other things that she has quoted or stated herself next meeting when we get into more of her book. Now, what does participation in the covenant entail? Let's see if you all know this verse. Know therefore that Yahweh thy Elohim, he is Elohim the faithful El, which keepeth covenant and something with them that love him. Now who wants to go out on a limb and guess what that word is? He keeps covenant and hesed with them that love him. And how do you define who loves him? The verse here says, keep his commandments for a long time. That's what this text says. All right, Matthew 18. Before we get into this story, I want to pose some questions that you can think about as the story unfolds. So I got a few questions, maybe one or two comments, but this is what Matthew 18 is. Now remember, I'm starting at 23. Not starting at verse 1, because verse 1 to 22 is a different subject, and then 23 to 35 is a second subject. So we're going to take that second subject. The following parable is a story of how the heavenly kingdom, and you're going to see that it's Yeshua stating, the kingdom of heaven is like this. That's his opening words. So this is a story of how the heavenly kingdom operates using an earthly example that we can all identify with. That's how he starts the story. Now, a question for us. Do we understand how forgiveness works? That's what it is. It's. Okay. Yeshua concludes his story by pointing out how the servant demonstrated his unworthiness of the king's forgiveness. That's interesting. What was the reason given? You'll see it when we get there. Did the servant earn forgiveness from the king? Looking at the story, did the servant somehow, with his works, manifest himself to such a degree that the king said, well, obviously I got to forgive you, as good as you are. Is that what the text is teaching us? Did the king have a sympathetic heart? Did he recognize the impossibility of the servant's position? That's where the fun and math section comes in. And was the king moved with compassion at the plea of the servant? Do any of these things remove the requirement of Hesed? You will have to make that decision. Where is Hesed in this parable? I'm going to give you a hint. In verse 33, Yeshua said through the words of the king, remember, he's telling the story, and these are the words that he is having the king say. The king says to the servant, you should have shown compassion to your fellow servant. Okay, talking about Hesed, the necessity of demonstrating the same attitude and action toward others. That was in the definition. So all I'm doing is pointing out how what Yeshua says here through the king is exactly what the definition says. When the servant fails to demonstrate Hesed, is he judged unworthy of the initial forgiveness? He was forgiven. It's clear. He was forgiven. The text is clear. He was forgiven. And yet, later on in the story, Yeshua says that the servant has been found unworthy of being forgiven. I think that's important. While he never earns the king's forgiveness, is the servant expected to transform his own behavior based on the event of forgiveness? I'll say that again. While he never earns the king's forgiveness, is he expected to transform his own behavior based on the act of forgiveness issued by the king? Does our behavior validate our king's calling us? Each one knows that answer. I make this statement. The way is about how we live, not about what we think. Because how I live demonstrates whether or not I have entered into a covenant relationship with the Almighty. How I live demonstrates whether I have entered into that covenant. Is that true or false? My life is a validation of his faithful decision to show forgiveness, not an exercise in gaining his approval. I'm trying to get different mind thoughts working here. Now, my final question before we start that text is, are we all actively involved in representing the kingdom on earth now? Because remember that Hesed is not your good thoughts and noble intentions. It's about doing something. All right, let's start. Verse 23, therefore is the kingdom of heaven likened unto a certain king which would take account of his servants. When he had begun to settle them, one, and I put in the Greek word EIS there because we're going to talk about one later. When he had begun to settle the accounts, one was brought unto him which owed him 10,000 talents. Now, we'll talk about, that's a lot. I mean, 10,000 pennies is a good number of pennies. Okay, so whatever this is, it's a lot. And I'm just putting this in for identification. One denarius equals a usual day labor's pay. So if you worked a day, maybe you were in the field, maybe you were picking apples or whatever you were doing, at the end of the day, you get a denarii. That's what you'd get. So, when fun with math, we'll sort this out for you. All right. Oh, one more comment. One talent, because this says 10,000, 1,000, one talent is 6,000 denarii. So, if a denarii is one day labor, then a talent is 6,000 days of labor. But there were 10,000 talents. That's a lot of days of labor, okay? And that's if this is a silver talent. Text doesn't say. If it was a gold talent, then when we get to our final number, multiply that by 30. Because the text doesn't say, so I don't know. So I'm going low on this one. All right, verse 25. But since he was not able to repay it, his Lord ordered him to be sold along with his wife and children. What did they ever do? This is how the system works. You can't pay your debt, your wife and your children go into slavery. And whatever he possessed, so that his repayment could be made. Then the slave threw himself to the ground before the king and said, "Be patient with me and I will repay you everything." Yeah, right. Want to see how that's going to be done. But that's what he said. And so the Lord had compassion on the slave and released him. And the text says, forgave him the debt. Now, I put the Greek word up there for forgive, forgave, forgive. And I'm going to show you some verses that you're familiar with in which this word appears. This Greek word appears. I want you to think about these things as you read these verses. All right, here we go. In Matthew 18, the fever left her. 19:29, everyone that hath forsaken houses or brethren or family. 27:50, Yeshua, when he had cried again with a loud voice, yielded up the ghost. These are all the same word translated forgive in this text. The woman then left her water pot and went into the city. Thou hast put all things in subjection unto his feet, for in that he put all in subjection unto him, he left nothing that was not put under him. Behold, your house is left unto you desolate. Two will be in the field, one will be taken, and the other left. Luke 7, wherefore I say unto thee, her sins, which are many, are forgiven. 1 John 2:12, I write unto you, little children, because your sins are forgiven you. These are a dozen examples of that Greek word in the New Testament and how it was translated. Same Greek word, a multiple list of different English words to translate it. Okay, continuing. This is the text. He had compassion, released him, forgave him the debt. 28, but afterwards, that same servant went out and found one of his fellow servants who owed him 100 denarii. Needless to say, that's a lot less than what he owed the king, but there you go. So he grabbed him by the throat and started to choke him, saying, I translated this directly from the Greek in its literal form, pay back what you owe me. All right, let's take fun with math for 100. Comparison. One talent equals 6,000 denarii. This is silver, not gold. 10,000 talents would be 10,000 times 6,000 would be 60 million denarii. Versus 100 denarii. It's a lot less, huh? It's a lot less. Now, let's take today in the Western world where we live. A good number of people start to work at the age of 20 and retire at the age of 65. So they work 45 years. That's kind of in there, okay? Now, 45, which is the number of years, times the number of days in a year you would work. Take how many weeks are there? There are 50 weeks. Well, there's 52, but let's say you get 2 weeks vacation. Okay, so you got 50 weeks. You work 5 days a week. That's 250. So some people work for 45 years, and in each year they work approximately 250 days, and that comes out to 11,250 days that they would work. But how much did you get paid in the first century if you worked a day? You got a denarii. So if you compare what you get that way to how much he actually owed, we're talking about 5,333 lifetimes of work is what that man owed the king. And the king forgave the debt. Yeah, it's a ridiculous number, I know. All right, continuing. Verse 29. Then his fellow slave threw himself down and begged him, be patient with me, and I will repay you. Where have we heard that line before? 30. But he refused. Instead, he had him cast into prison until he could repay the debt. 31, when his fellow slaves saw what had happened, they were very upset and went and told their lord everything that had taken place. 32, then the lord called the first slave and said to him, evil slave. I looked this up in the Greek because evil is a very strong word to call somebody. But it is the word for evil, so I put it in the text. That's how I translated it. Evil slave, I forgave you all that debt because you begged me. Should you not have shown mercy to your fellow slave just as I showed mercy to you? That's the king's question. I showed mercy to you. Shouldn't you have shown mercy to the next person? Tell me, why should he have shown mercy? This is Yeshua speaking through the voice of the king in the story that he's telling. Why should he have shown mercy? A question to be answered. 34, and his lord, moved with anger, turned him over to the prison guards, I put the Greek word there, until he repaid all he owed. Now, let me tell you about this word. Some of you may be familiar with it. In Freiburg, as a legal, technical term, one who examines by using torture, so you could call them a judicial examining tormentor or something like that. All right, how do we understand that word in our culture? People would hide their money back then, and so a bag man or a debt collector would be used to secure true testimony on where your money was hidden so the debt could be repaid. We would understand that from, if you've ever seen movies or read stories about the mob. And if somebody owed something, who would be sent out to get that money? And what actions would they take to find out what you had so they could take it? That's the Greek word that's here. We are going to turn you over to the mob. That's basically what this is saying. And let's see how that works out. Right? Final verse. So likewise, my heavenly Father will do to you. Let me repeat that opening sentence. Likewise, my heavenly Father will do to you if each of you does not forgive your brother from your heart. Now, I have to add here, this is not an isolated occurrence of this concept. In Matthew 6:14, it says, if you forgive men, that's mankind, their trespasses, your heavenly Father will also forgive you. But then there's verse 15. But if you will not forgive men their trespasses, then your heavenly Father's not going to forgive you. Also, I don't have the text here, but many of us are familiar with the Lord's Prayer. Forgive us our debts as we forgive those who have trespassed against us. And there are others. All right, let's do an analysis of what we have seen. The people in verse 1, what do we know about them? Well, we've gone through Paul in chapter 8. We've got Peter in chapter 10. Peter reports back to Jerusalem in chapter 11. Gentiles are coming in, and what are we to do? What are we supposed to do with this? So the people in verse 1 have been called by the Almighty. These believers were already believers in Yeshua. They had learned that to inherit the kingdom, think about the Pharisee. This is the ones who are very well educated in understanding the Torah of the day. And they understood that you have to be able to be in the covenant to inherit the kingdom, which is the seventh day is what we would understand that, which is the millennial kingdom. That's the next age that's coming up. So these Pharisaic believers had been taught that you have to inherit the kingdom. So you must enter the covenant, and to do that, you have to fulfill the terms. And fulfilling the terms is hesed. So if you don't know the terms, you can't fulfill them. And if you can't fulfill them, let's go back and read Matthew 18 again and see what it says is going to happen to you if you don't fulfill what has taken place toward you. What the definition early on, you have to give out what you have been given. So these Pharisaic believers are very concerned that these people are coming in, but they have no clue what to do. But there's a solution to this in their mind. Okay? Look what they say in verse 5. This is the Greek. It's divinely necessary for them to become proselytes because of what's going to happen when you become a proselyte. So let's just go through and break it down. Okay? I got details coming up in my slide here. I have a question. Why do they need to become proselytes in the minds of the Pharisees so they can enter into the covenant after having learned the terms? So what we want you to do is, you want to become a part of what God is doing, then we're going to tell you everything you have to do and everything you can't do. We're going to inform you about that. And we're going to test you on a regular basis with pop quizzes and a few other things. And then at the end, we're going to give you a final exam. And if you pass that, then we're going to perform the ritual in which you become a proselyte. And we'll be okay with that because we know that you know what to do and we know that you know what not to do. That's what they were taught. All right, so doesn't sound so bad to me. We're talking about Gentiles, right? People from the other nations coming in. Now, we know that there's some Jews, but that's not what this text is talking about. This text is talking about people, not Jews, who are now just coming. Oh, Yeshua is the Messiah. He is the one that was sent. That's not who we're talking about. We're talking about people who are outside of Israel. We'll look at those verses later on that speak about that, that Paul wrote in Ephesians 2. I have them here on the screen. All right, but what we're talking about today, we've got Gentiles who are outside the community of Israel. They've been called by the Almighty. Well, what did these people look like? We're talking first century. What did Gentiles look like? Let me share with you some attributes of Gentiles in the first century. Okay? A person who intentionally abuses another with speech, or whose speech is vulgar and indecent, has ongoing sexual relationships with a prostitute, adulterers, idolaters, homosexuals, thieves, drunkards, those violently greedy, swindlers, murderers. Did I make all this up? Oh, yes. It's in these three passages right here. This is the text that I just took and just read to you. And why is this so important? Because it says, the people who do this shall not inherit the kingdom, even if they're in the covenant. That's what the text says. So it's not enough to be called and to enter into the covenant. If you're not behaving properly, then you will not inherit the kingdom. So what are the Pharisees thinking? We are in a dangerous situation here, and it is divinely imperative that we teach these people how to behave before we accept them into the community. And Paul was saying, no, no. And there was a great dispute, and they said, let's go to Jerusalem and ask James and the elders in Jerusalem, what do you think about this? That's what the discussion is here. Let's continue. The process of becoming a proselyte teaches about not doing certain things. We've seen that. We've already gone through Exodus, Leviticus. We have just a few chapters left, and we'll be through with Numbers. So there's a whole bunch of things there that are clear for us. Now, The final ritual, after you get through all of this, is think about Pharisee mindset. It initiates you into the covenant because you passed your final exam. And isn't it wonderful that they already know what's required to meet the terms of the covenant? We feel good with this. This is of a divine imperative. We've got to make sure they know what to do before they become part of our family. All right? Now, I ask this question. Why is this bad? Why is it bad to learn before you do? You know, I was thinking about the other day about brain surgery. And I said to myself, I need to have brain surgery. Let me get somebody who just started medical school. Yeah, I feel good with that. I'll tell you what's bad. Galatians 5, 1 through 4 covers it. Let's take a look at that text. Verse 1, stand fast therefore in the liberty where Christ has made us free, and be not entangled again with the yoke of bondage. Behold, I, Paul, say unto you that if you become a proselyte, the work of Christ, the blood of Christ on the cross, has no value for you. This is what Paul is teaching. Galatians is one of the earliest books he wrote, just so you know. All right? And this is what he's saying. If you become a proselyte, the work of Christ, which was this great work that Christ did, forget it. It has no value to do. You can't do nothing with it. This is what he's teaching. This is verse 2. Verse 3. I testify again. This is a legal word. Go in court. Put my hand on the book. Raise the other one and say, I testify the truth. That's the word there. I testify again, Paul says, to everyone that becomes a proselyte, that they have obligated themselves by an oath to do the Torah and all the traditions. That's the problem. And he was trying to shut that down. All right. Here's verse 4. Christ has become of no effect. I have highlighted of no effect because we're going to look at the Greek word there. You have seen it before in another passage, and I'm going to go over the definition again because I want you to understand what that word means in its root form. Christ has become of no effect unto you. Whosoever of you are justified by the law, fallen from grace. Because of the things that you have now committed yourself to do, the work of Christ is outside of your realm, and you have lost that value. Do not become a proselyte. I don't care how good it sounds, is what Paul's message is in these four verses of Galatians. Now, let's take a look at this Greek word. I want you to, just like you saw examples of the Greek word that was translated forgive in our passage and translated by some other English words in some other passages, let's look at the Greek word that's here. Christ has become of no effect. Here's the Greek word. Where have you seen this before? Here's the text. Ephesians 2, 15. Having abolished, you see the Greek, the highlighted word abolished is this Greek word, having abolished in his flesh the enmity, even the law of commandments contained in ordinances, for to make in himself one new man. Okay, this is the text, we're familiar with it. What does the word mean? Let's go to a Greek dictionary, Freiburg, from the basic sense, caused to be idle or useless. The term always denotes non-physical destruction. Not physical destruction, we didn't blow up anything. Always denotes non-physical destruction. But this is how. By means of a superior force coming in to replace the force that was previously in effect. This is when you use that Greek word. This force is the authority force. It's sitting here. It has authority. It has power. It executes actions. But then something happened, and this force came in and displaced this by causing this force to be have no power, to be like a car in which they took the engine out. Looks good, but it can't go nowhere. Has no value. Render inoperative is another English phrase that I thought was pretty good. And I put in also to cause something to lose its power. This is the word that is in Ephesians 2:15. So he, when he died, one of the actions, one of the results of his death was the power that was sitting over here. He came in and caused this to have no power, and he became the power. That's what that Greek, that's when you use that Greek word, which is used there. And the proselyte discussion in Galatians 5 is if you become a proselyte, then the power of Christ will then be removed and made no power and will be replaced with man-made traditions that you just made an oath you have to keep. That's when you use that Greek word. All right, let's continue with our analysis. Acts 10 was a while back, but we know the story. These people received the Spirit, a sign that they had entered into the covenant. What did Peter say? Hey, same thing took place with them that took place with us. I got my buddies here from Judea, my other Pharisee friends, who were really opposed to this, and he turns to them, smart man, anybody here want to deny them baptism? And the room was silent. And so they baptize him. That's what Acts 10 says. Now, they receive the Spirit. Where do we see this? Yeshua made the following statement. The Spirit of truth, whom the world cannot receive because it seeth him not, does not know him, but you know him, and he dwells with you and shall be in you. That's what the text says. Dwells with you, disciples, and shall be in you. Why is this true? All right, let's take a look at how we know this is the text and what it says. What do we get from Amos? Surely Yahweh will do nothing, but he reveals the secret unto his servants, the prophets. That's 3:7. What does Ezekiel say? It's talking about another time in a greater dimension, but I'm using this text because it's so clear. I will take you from among the heathen. Who are we? We are among the heathen, and we are on our way out. And gather you out of all the countries and bring you into your own land. Then I'll sprinkle clean water on you, and you'll be clean and all your filthiness. So there's some type of spiritual cleaning from your idols. I will cleanse you. Process 26, a new heart will I give you, and a new spirit will I put within you. I'll take away the stony heart, and I will give you a heart of flesh. And 27 concludes it with, I will put my spirit within you, and here's the results. Here's what that looks like. Cause you to walk in my statutes, and you will keep my judgments and do them. That's an example text. All right? Let's look at it in Paul's writings. Let's just align these things. Wherefore, remember that in time past, you were a Gentile. That's a pagan heathen. In the flesh. That's where you're starting from. At that time, you were without Christ, one, aliens from, the KJV translates this as Commonwealth of Israel. Commonwealth comes from the Brits, and so we can get a feel for that. But the word there in Greek is, I'll spell it, P-O-L-I-T-E-I-A-S, politeus. We get our word politic from that. And in the next meeting, I will break down what that word means in much more detail. But here it's translated, aliens from the Commonwealth of Israel. Two, strangers from the covenants of promise. That's strangers, and I don't have access to the covenants. That's three. Four, I have no hope. That sounds like, what's that guy's name? Enter here without hope. Nine circles. Dante, have no hope. That's what happens when you enter in there. That's what the sign over the door says. And five, without God, you have no access to God. That's where you're starting from. Then, let's look what Paul says in the next verse. But now in Messiah Yeshua, you who were formerly far away have been brought near by the blood of Messiah. He talks about a few other things and concludes it at 19. Therefore, you are no longer strangers and foreigners, but, and I put the Greek word there, and here's the translation of it, possessing the same citizenship as your fellow Israelites, making you members of the household of God. When you accept the work of Yeshua, you now join in with these others who accepted the work of Yeshua, and you're part of the household of God. That's what the text is saying. All right, back to Acts 15, 1. This is really a statement of concern by these Pharisees who believe for the new ones who have been touched by the Almighty, because they want to make sure they can enter into the covenant. And the way Paul is teaching is not how it used to be done. This is a change. And these Pharisees are not up to speed. So what is going to happen, and I'm just going to give you, we'll call this a spoiler alert. James and the elders get together and say, this is what has happened. We have to go into our scriptures, which was only the Torah writings and prophets at that time. We have to go in there and find out, was this prophesied? And if so, what does it mean and what do we have to do? That's a spoiler alert. But we'll get there, okay? The problem that these Pharisees had, because they just hadn't been brought up to speed, and if you remember, later on, when you get into the 20s of chapter 15, what do you get? James approves, the apostles approve, the elders approve, all the assembly members in Jerusalem approve, the Spirit approves, and there could be some others. Everyone approved of James' solution to this problem, which was an error in judgment by the Pharisees. The reason was, you don't have to go take all these tests and pass this final exam to enter in the covenant. You're already in the covenant, was the answer. And they did not know that. And you'll see that later on in Acts 15. They had been called. I leave you with this last thought. Of course, many are called. But what's the end of that passage? Few are chosen. And that is the end of this presentation. I will now take questions.